Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode, we'll spotlight a remarkable woman from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in. Okay, so first of all, last episode was our very first, and we want to thank you all so much for the warm reception of the Sharon Tate episode.
It means so much.
That was your first time in the writing chair. Emma, how did it feel?
Oh, it was great. I really enjoyed bringing this story to you, and I loved seeing how many of you enjoyed to listen, and that we just had the possibility to give Sharon the story and the episode that she deserved.
I learned so much about her from that episode, so thank you for teaching me about an incredible career and a wonderful life that I really wish wasn't cut short so soon, because she would have gone on to do amazing things, whichever path she shows. Yeah. Motherhood, acting, or both.
I truly believe so too. Yeah.
So what have we been up to since our last episode? We've had some pretty big life events. Congratulations, Emma, I'm getting married!
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's crazy.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either, honestly. I can't. And the last episode when we were talking about Sharon, I wanted to interject the entire time because I'm really bad at keeping secrets. And I got, by the time that you're going to listen to this, it'll probably be up and all over my Instagram because I'm so obsessed.
I can't wait
but
to see.
But I got Sharon's wedding dress remade. And it is the most special thing. I had been looking for a mini dress. I wanted like a short one and then a long one for the party. And I wanted to have her dress, and I kept looking. And her dress is like in a museum now, and obviously it's very expensive. But my dear friend Coco, she voluntarily made me pretty much the same dress. It looks perfect, just like hers, and it is tailored to me. So that was truly special.
I'm so happy for you too, and your little family. It's been so wonderful seeing you build your little family and start your lives together. So congratulations to the happy couple.
That means so much.
And to many more years of happiness and love.
Yeah, we truly had such a special day.
Let's continue this celebratory feeling into our next episode. Let's get things going.
Yes.
All right, so for my first episode in the writer's chair, I wanted to spotlight a woman in line with kind of what I do on the internet and what I'll be bringing to the show moving forward. As many Beatles and Stones albums as I've reviewed, my greatest hits are when I write about counterculture groups. If you've seen my videos, it's not hard to see why I'm drawn to this side of the 60s. You can either credit or blame my middle school guitar teacher, yes, I tried to learn an instrument once, it didn't go great, for my enduring fascination with today's doll. He put the Woodstock performance of White Rabbit on as an example of what the 60s were all about. This was one of many first glimpses before I fully went down the rabbit hole 5-ish years ago. Today will be far from a comprehensive overview of this woman's career, having released 8 studio albums with Jefferson Airplane, 7 with Jefferson Starship, 2 with Starship, 3 albums with Paul Kantner, 4 solo albums, live records, and even more guest appearances on other people's stuff. She was truly prolific. To best benefit the story and account for this frankly ridiculous output, we'll be going in mostly chronological order. Today, Emma and I will tell the story of who Forbes described as, quote, the face that launched 1,000 trips. It's the acid queen herself, living legend, Grace Slick.
Grace Barnett Wing was born October 30th in 1939 in a suburb of Chicago to Ivan Wing and his wife, Virginia. Grace's birthday coincides with an informal American holiday known as Cabbage Night, Mischief Night, or the Devil's Night. Teenagers celebrate Cabbage Night by generally causing chaos. doing things like toilet papering trees or egging neighbors' houses. As we'll see throughout today's story, Grace seems to have been born with this day's troublemaking energy. Her family was quite well off as Ivan worked as an investment banker. The wings moved several times for Ivan's job, but they were always comfortable. By 1950, the family settled in Palo Alto, California. Ivan was very by the book and taught Grace how to be smart with money. He gave his daughter such advice as buying bonds instead of stocks and to invest in real estate.
That's advice my grandpa gives me. He says there's only so much dirt you can buy. They're not making any more planet.
That's really wise, though. Virginia was a jazz singer turned homemaker, and her little brother Chris on classical music and opera. Grace seemed to be born with an innate knowing. The 1950s weren't all they were cracked up to be. Abusing stimulants, sleeping pills, and alcohol were normalized under the guise of squeaky clean teen idols, fluffy skirts, and milkshakes. The 1960s have a reputation of the drug decade, but the 50s was a decade of self-medication, and Grace knew it. Picturesque an upbringing as she had, she was troubled. As we'll see today, alcohol plays a major role in Grace's life. She'd been drinking, in quotes, since she was a kid. When she reached her teenage years, Ivan and Virginia transferred their daughter to an all-girls school, then sent her to Finch College. Not only would she have the best education money could buy, her rebellious ways might be ironed out. So I attended a Catholic all-girls school, and I want to interject here because I feel like there's this general misconception. So people, parents will put their daughters in schools like that, and they're like, oh, she will get straightened up. But the reality is that all the girls there are sent there to do that, and it just makes for a big class of troublemaking girls. And I loved my time at that school, but I feel like for her it kind of was the same thing. Like, it didn't work afterwards. She didn't went on to live a, in quote, normal life.
That happens here in the States too. It's the same. Finch College wasn't much of a college. It was a finishing school meant to teach the daughters of wealthy, influential families the skills a lady of high society would need to know. How to set a table for a dinner party, how to carry polite conversation, how to gracefully exit a car, various dress codes, and what jewelry to pair with what dress. Basically, how to have class. Grace hated it there. According to her, Finch was, and I quote, dumb. She had no desire to be a typical housewife, let alone a prim and proper socialite. Quote, I didn't really want to go, but you can't say to your parents, can I have $15,000 or $20,000 to go screw around in New York? I love the way this woman talks. She talks just like me. After spending 1 year at Finch, Grace enrolled in the University of Miami to study art. She dropped out a year after that and returned to California. To support herself, she turned to modeling. She did do some print work, the photos circulate online from time to time, but her most significant job was at the flagship location of iMagnon. Emma, you might recognize that name. The store was name-dropped in Vertigo.
Oh, I do. Kim Novak's character, I think her name is Julie, if I recall that. Oh, Judy, if I recall that correctly. But she said, and I love that, she said, I'm just a girl, I work at Magnans. And I love that so much because I feel like it just sums up the playful bit of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just so...
It's like, I'm just a girl. I'm just a 24-year-old teenage girl. It's like that.
I love it. Yeah, it's just like so funny and it works so well with her character. And it really brightens up this in other ways very dark and disturbing movie.
iMagnon no longer exists. It was bought out by Macy's in the 90s. But back in the 60s, it was one of California's premier luxury department store chains. iMagnon wasn't much like typical modeling, not like a runway show where potential buyers ooh and ah dresses from afar. These models were part sales associate, part live mannequin. They'd wear the store's lavish designs, costing as much as $10,000 on the sales floor as they mingled with customers. Patrons could approach them, feel the fabric themselves, and see how the garment moved on a real girl. They could ask who designed the outfit and how much it cost, sort of like interviewers on a red carpet do. Then she'd change into her next outfit and start the whole thing over again. But, like finishing school, Grace didn't care for working at iMagnon. She resented the traditionally feminine role of be seen and not heard, do not speak unless spoken to.
On August 26, in 1961, at age 22, Grace married her first husband, ex-army man Jerry Slick. Please bear with us, there are going to be a lot of Jerrys in this story. Yep. Abby's not sure how exactly they met, but sources she found state Grace and Jerry were next-door neighbors. Up until now, Grace's life has been fairly by the book, going to good schools to get a good education, working a traditionally feminine job, and getting married to the boy next door. But all of this was about to change. The Slicks were far from traditional. They quenched each other's thirst for knowledge, steeping themselves in the local beatnik scene. California beatniks were all about poetry, jazz, music, experimental films, and growing marijuana in their backyards. Jerry enrolled in filmmaking courses at San Francisco State College, and the Slicks cultivated marijuana plants of their own. Some of Grace's earliest music work are scores she composed for Jerry's films. His 1964 work, Everybody Hits Their Brother Once, won first prize at the Ann Arbor Music Festival that year. But still, even after this success, Grace didn't consider pursuing music. Hearing the Beatles didn't move her. The Rolling Stones only mildly piqued her interest. Then she read about a certain local folk group in the newspaper.
Let's take a break from Grace's life to introduce the band that made her famous. Jefferson Airplane formed in 1965-ish as the project of singer Marty Balin and guitarist Paul Kantner. Marty wanted a house band for his pizza parlor turned nightclub, The Matrix, and recruited some like-minded musicians. Buddy Paul, his buddy from college Jorma Kaukonen, bluegrass bassist Bob Harvey, and drummer Jerry Peliquin. Smoking pot was thoroughly normalized in the group, and by 1964, Paul had already taken lysergic acid dithalamide. Abbreviation, LSD, common name, acid. Jerry Peliquin didn't last long, seeing as he wasn't into the whole acid thing, so Skip Spence replaced him. Fascinating guy, by the way, he released one of the best singer-songwriter albums of the entire 1960s. Really interesting guy. After a few months, Bob was replaced by Jack Cassidy. The Airplane had a solid enough lineup since both Marty and Paul could sing, but they wanted a female singer. Enter Signe Anderson. No, Grace Slick is not a founding member of the band, as casual fans might assume. Jefferson Airplane soon became fixtures on the San Francisco folk scene, playing the club circuit and early happenings. Signe's voice was one of the band's biggest draws. She was a powerhouse. She could sing pretty much anything, whether it was jazz or folk. Her signature number was Chauffeur Blues. The Airplane made enough noise to land a deal with RCA Victor. This made them the first band from the San Francisco scene to be signed to a major label. They released one LP with this original lineup, Jefferson Airplane Takes Off, then had to re-release a censored version. The Airplane never took the easy flight pattern. I have this uncensored version. The lyric change is so insignificant, I honestly don't know how RCA caught it.
Grace attended a Jefferson Airplane gig in the summer of 1965. When she saw Signe and the guys on stage, she caught the rock and roll bug. Grace liked how being a singer sounded. She only really had to work for a couple of hours, then she could drink, hang out, and, in quotes, hustle. Meanwhile, Jerry Slick and his brother Darby were really into the Beatles and wanted to start a band of their own. The Slicks joined forces, then found a second guitarist and a bassist slash saxophone player. Grace learned how to play some guitar and bass, and her first group, The Great Society, was born. The band's name was meant to mock President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. They only cut one single, Darby's Somebody to Love, but they gained serious traction in the San Francisco scene. They even opened for Jefferson Airplane, making buttons that mocked the Jefferson Airplane Loves You slogan. Grace and Company's version was, The Great Society really doesn't like you much.
While in the Great Society, Grace wrote what would become the anthem of a generation. High on LSD and listening to Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain over and over, as you do, Grace wrote White Rabbit on a broken piano in about an hour. You don't get much more psychedelic 60s than that. White Rabbit begins as a critique of the squeaky clean 1950s of Grace's youth. One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Grace has always been about expanding your horizons and educating yourself. Quote, through literacy, you can begin to see the universe. Through music, you can reach anybody. Between the two, there is you, unstoppable. White Rabbit's rallying cry of feed your head means any number of things. Read books, pick up an instrument, write poetry, go to a protest, take LSD. Whichever avenue you choose, it's yours. Go down the rabbit hole. Change yourself and don't look back. The rest of the Great Society workshopped White Rabbit into their signature song. It's more of an exotic saxophone freakout than the tune we know it as today, very representative of psychedelia's fascination with the East. If at all possible, let's hear a few seconds of what the original White Rabbit sounded like.
I think the Alice in Wonderland references are far from a coincidence. I read that Alice in Wonderland was her favorite book, and in many ways Grace was like Alice, wanting to escape the classic societal norms and living a dream life, allowing her to do what she wanted and to be who she liked.
She was never by the book, as we'll see in throughout the rest of her life. She basically looked at the rule book, said, I don't need this, I'm gonna do the exact opposite. Just threw it away and forged forward. Sometimes that gets her in sticky situations, as we'll see. But, I mean, you gotta commend that bravery to totally reject a norm.
Sure, people flocked to hear the Great Society, but they mostly wanted to experience beauty of the band Grace Slick and her undeniable stage presence. Her bright blue eyes, so blue Patti Smith described them as purple against her fair, oval-shaped face, and dark hair had a hypnotic effect on the crowd. Her voice was resonant, bouncing off the club walls and echoing around the room. She was Snow White and the Poison Apple. If those buttons were any indication, she had edge. Over time, the band drummed up enough attention for Columbia Records to offer them a deal. This was major. Columbia was the leading folk label at the time. They had Bob Dylan on their roster. But before the papers arrived in the mail, fate came knocking on Grace Slick's door. In the fall of 1966, Signe Anderson discovered she was pregnant. It's important to note here that these were the times before Joan Baez was playing Woodstock while pregnant. At this time in the 60s, being a mother and being a working musician were mutually exclusive. Signe chose to start her family. She played her last show with The Airplane on October 15th at the Fillmore. She received a standing ovation for her final Chauffeur Blues. Now entering Grace Slick. And Spencer Dryden too. Spencer replaced Skip Spence after he left to form Moby Grape. When Jack Cassidy asked Grace to join The Airplane, she jumped at the chance. She liked that they conducted themselves like professionals, whereas The Great Society was more of a family band vibe. She also thought Jack was hot. The Great Society couldn't continue without Grace as their focal point though, and neither could Slick's marriage. Both the band and the marriage were done.
Signe was a folk girl. She wore flowy dresses and bows in her hair. I have that first Jefferson Airplane Takes Off record, and I love her presence on it. She brought that sort of, you know, the San Francisco flowery free love energy to the band. Grace's voice had a similar power, but personality-wise, she couldn't be more different. She was fiery, assertive, and blunt. With Grace co-piloting the airplane alongside Marty and Paul, the airplane style shifted. Guitars took center stage, with Marty and Grace's harmonies in the center. With three principal songwriters now, all contributing their own tunes, Jefferson Airplane were an unstoppable force. Production began on their second record the day after Grace's 27th birthday. Their secret weapon, friend of the band, and spiritual advisor, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. See, we told you there were a lot of Jerrys in this story. Recorded in about 3 weeks, the album was to be called Surrealistic Pillow. The two songs Grace brought with her from the Great Society days were to become Jefferson Airplane's greatest hits. About recording Somebody to Love, Grace recalls, quote, I remember being in front of the microphone, then listening to the playback on four big Altec speakers in Studio A of the control room at RCA in Los Angeles. I remember thinking, my God, that is amazing. They make it sound like I can really sing. And she could sing. Grace's lead vocal debut with The Airplane landed them their highest charting hit. Though the album was released in February of 1967, and the first single, My Best Friend, flopped, Marty and Paul's tune, Today, was picked up by college radio. That helped get Surrealistic Pillow in the hands of more fans. The next single, Somebody to Love, peaked at number 5 the week of June 17th. The Airplane reworked White Rabbit, too. It was transformed into a Spanish march inspired by Ravel's Bolero. The cutting-edge psych-rock classical hybrid proved to be the Airplane's most enduring hit. It peaked at number 8 on the Billboard charts the week of July 29th. It may have inspired Beck's Bolero the next year. It's since been covered countless times. Two twin anthems of the summer of love dominating the charts at the same time, both sung by Grace, off a record widely considered one of the best of the 1960s. It's a wonderful album. I'm sure those listening to this show have at least heard those two songs, but it doesn't sound like anything else in the Airplane's catalog. It's got this really unique, resonant sound. There's this sort of, you know, that lingering folksy magic. It truly is one of the best albums of the decade. Anyway, if I keep going about music, we're gonna be here for 2 hours, because that's what I do. Grace said, quote, "I always felt like a good-looking school teacher singing White Rabbit. I sang the words slowly and precisely so the people who needed to hear them wouldn't miss the point. But they did." Grace didn't consider herself pretty. Like a lot of us women seem to do, she only saw her perceived flaws. Her hair wasn't just curly, it was kinky. Girl same. To get it somewhat manageable, she styled it in a typical 60s style. Straight, falling just below her shoulders, with heavy side-swept fringe. Her eyebrows were thin and light, her eyelashes blonde, so she wore dark eyeliner and mascara. She thought her legs were short and her chest was too flat, but none of that mattered. On May 7th, 1967, Jefferson Airplane made their first appearance on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Grace didn't take her eyes off the camera once through White Rabbit. Hordes of young men across America tuned in to watch and found themselves bewitched by a blue-eyed siren. The counterculture found the woman of their dreams. Grace became a certified sex symbol, her face splashed across magazine pages. Surrealistic Pillow's success called for a follow-up. After Bathing at Baxter's, slang for, you guessed it, taking acid. Their sound got heavier, due in part to Grace and Paul at the helm. They edged previous pilot Marty out of the cockpit. Oh my god, count all of the flight-related puns in this episode. This sparked a decades-long love-hate relationship between him and Grace. She and Paul were inspired by groups like the Jimi Hendrix Experience and Cream hitting the big time.
Despite minor hit, the ballad of You and Me and Puneel and Grace's original Rejoice, Baxter didn't perform nearly as well as Surrealistic Pillow did. Nevertheless, there was a mass interest in Grace's back catalog. In 1968, a collection of live recordings were issued as two albums, conspicuous only in its absence and how it was. Both were later repackaged as a double album called Collector's Item, which Abby owns a copy of, and I'm jealous of.
I found this. We're going to go off on a tangent here. This was like a couple years ago.
It's fine.
Was filming for this documentary that never got made, and we were doing some B-roll footage in one of my favorite record stores. I was on like a huge psych kick then, so I picked up like Jimmy Page era Yardbirds, and I picked up that really weird rock opera the Bee Gees did.
I love that.
You do?
It's so underrated. I think it is very weird, and like sometimes it's, how do I say it? It like takes some strength to listen to it, but there's something so good about it. I don't know how to say it. It just, something inside of me is drawn to that. Every now and then, I'll put it on and I'll listen to the whole thing.
It's like listening to really early David Bowie, you know, that sort of psych pop thing.
Yeah.
And I, like, go to the counter to check out. I think we'd, like, put the cameras down for that moment. And this place has stamp cards. So if you fill up all the stamps on your card, you get a discount. And I got my discount.
Great.
And I'm just like, I'm going right back into those stacks and I am grabbing that Great Society compilation. I bought it for
yes.
White Rabbit alone. That pays the price of admission for me. Grace wasn't just a pretty face. Her and Jefferson Airplane were a brash, arrogant crew, uncompromising in their beliefs, creatively and politically. Watching her interviews, you'll note how pointed Grace is. She's articulate, speaks precisely, and doesn't waste a single word. Some might go as far as to say she sounds like a nerd when she talks, and that's because she is. She's such a music nerd. Her band's cutting-edge sound brought San Francisco to the masses, giving a boost to the Grateful Dead, Country Joe and the Fish, and Big Brother and the Holding Company featuring Janis Joplin. These bands shifted attention from previous cultural epicenter London over to American soil. Sure, the Beatles were experimenting with LSD, see Revolver, but Jefferson Airplane had been hip to it for years. They were openly singing about it on their albums. Their radical far-left politics put them on the music industry's and the United States government's radar. Cue the FBI assigning undercover agents to track them from gig to gig, including Martha Wax, who got close enough to inspire several Jefferson Airplane songs. I think the song Martha is on Baxter's, and that's the one about her. One thing to know about Grace is that she likes to find the line of what is socially acceptable and dance all over it. Whether it's being an early proponent of psychedelic drugs, cursing directly into the mic, or openly embracing being a sex symbol, she did it to get a rise out of people. For one, in 1969, I'm so glad I get to introduce this word to the show, she might have been the first person to say motherfucker on television via the Ed Sullivan Show.
And now you are the first person to say it on this podcast.
As I should be. Yeah, you know what? As I should be. I'm wearing my MC5 t-shirt right now. Kick out the jams, motherfucker.
You're so on brand.
It is. I love that cursing is like wrapped into my brand. The Airplane notoriously appeared on American Bandstand in robes, visibly tripping without a care. When the host asked if parents should worry, Paul said, I think so. They called for revolution in their songs and interviews. Though non-violent, it still ruffled the general public's feathers. 1968's Crown of Creation opened with Lather, a song which Grace sings about her fling with drummer Spencer. Triad, off the same album, was written by David Crosby about a threesome. The Grace-penned Greasy Heart is similarly racy. Boys, she's got more to play with in the way of toys. Fans ate it up. To promote the album, and thanks to director Jean-Luc Godard, Jefferson Airplane took to the roof of the Hotel Schuyler in New York. That's right, they beat the Beatles to the rooftop idea by 2 whole months. It was a chilly morning in November. At 7:45 a.m., their set began with, "Hello, New York! New York, wake up, you fuckers!" After a screeching psychedelic freakout, they were shut down by New York's finest. On top of the Airplane's penchant for shocking the public, Grace had no qualms about provoking audiences. In November, the Airplane returned to Smothers Brothers. They performed Lather, a favorite tune of mine, and Crown of Creation. During the latter of the two, Grace raised the Black Power fist. While in blackface, she was portrayed this way on the cover of Teen Set magazine. Oh, wow. She's defended herself by saying she simply wanted to wear all the makeup they had in the trailer. However, the black gloves she wore with her white suit said otherwise. The near constant controversies put the band at odds with manager Bill Graham. It all came to a head when, during an argument, Grace declared either Bill goes or I go. Bill got the pink slip. Jefferson Airplane biography Got a Revolution describes an incident at a 1969 fundraiser for the Whitney Museum of American Art. I was just there the other week. I didn't know Airplane did a gig for that. Grace got drunk, hopped on the mic, and ripped into the audience. The quotes are really something, to say the least.
Yeah, it's pretty far out.
Something I would even say on this podcast.
Of the three iconic 60s music festivals the Airplane played, Monterey Pop in June of 1967 was Grace's favorite. And I have to say, I'm with her on that. If I had to choose, and while I would have loved to attend Woodstock, I would always choose the Monterey Pop Festival. It just seems like the better spot. In quotes, I'd heard Jimi Hendrix records, but had never seen him live. Her first experience gig was a real treat. This was the night Jimmy lit his guitar on fire to upstage The Who. In quotes, I had never seen the Mamas and the Papas, Ravi Shankar, The Who. We were all standing on the edge of the stage behind little black curtains. We were just as fascinated as the audience. The Airplane performs today in the Monterey Pop documentary. One of this film's quirks is an extended shot of Grace singing the song. Someone on either the filming or editing crew didn't realize it was Marty doing the singing. So one long take of Grace just mouthing the words is in the final cut of the movie. You need to see that. I think it's even on YouTube. Yeah.
It's still there.
It's crazy. You could have gone back at one point and like fixed that. But like, I feel like now it's a cult thing. Years of relentless gigging, recording, and literally screaming from rooftops wreaked havoc on Grace's voice. In early 1969, Jefferson Airplane went on hiatus, and she underwent surgery. This was to remove nodes on her vocal cords. Jack and Jorma used this time to form their own band, Hot Tuna. After 4 months' recovery, Grace and Jefferson Airplane went back into the studio to record Volunteers. This material was central to the band's Woodstock set. According to Grace, Woodstock was, in quotes, a mess. For one, the traffic jam was so bad the airplane had to be flown into Max Jasker's farm by helicopter. Whichever crew organized that stunt missed out on a great joke. The PA system was a mess too. There were no speakers pointed back at the performers, meaning they couldn't hear themselves. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were among many victims of this goof. Jefferson Airplane was scheduled to play around 9:30 p.m. on day two, but because the whole festival ran so late, they didn't play until 6 o'clock the next morning. Grace remembers, in quotes, "We hung out all night backstage and around the sides, so all I saw were people's butts." You'd think they'd have been exhausted waiting up all night to play, but in typical rock and roll fashion, the band loaded up on cocaine backstage to stay awake. Finally, at sunrise on the third day, Jefferson Airplane took the stage. Grace wore a white lace-up tunic with knee-skimming fringe, matching white bell-bottoms and her natural hair. Her wild curls blew in the wind as she opened the airplane set with the now legendary words, "Now you're going to hear some Morning Maniac music." In the Woodstock documentary, you can literally see one of the guy's drugs kicking in as they're playing.
I think it was Paul, but I don't remember because it's been so long. Whoever it is, his eyes blow up as wide as saucers. It's so funny.
It really is. Despite how run ragged they were, they played one of the best sets of the whole weekend. To this day, we talk about Jimi Hendrix playing the national anthem and Jefferson Airplane playing White Rabbit. Their set also included a fiery rendition of anti-Vietnam War song Volunteers. The album of the same name was the band's most political work.
That's my personal favorite number from their set at Woodstock is Volunteers. They sound great on that. In hopes to bring the magic of Woodstock to the West Coast, members of the Airplane and the Grateful Dead organized a free show at Golden Gate Park. The show seemed to be cursed from the jump. Amidst difficulties with the police, the venue changed first to Sonoma Raceway, then to Altamont Speedway last minute. There was no way Altamont could handle an audience of 300,000 people, but out of desperation, they went through with it anyway. During all this, the Airplane was preoccupied with touring. Grace said, quote, "We'd used Hell's Angels in the parks for free concerts before. Paul and I flew over to Mick Jagger beforehand. Hey, they are really good," we said. This proved to be a terrible mistake. Rampant drug and alcohol use agitated both the Hells Angels and the crowd. Several performers were injured. Denise Jukes of all-girl rock group The Ace of Cups had her skull fractured by an airborne beer bottle. She was 6 months pregnant. Marty was knocked out cold by a Hells Angel during Jefferson Airplane's set. Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills, and Nash was stabbed in the leg during their performance. Outside the venue, two people died in a car crash, and one drowned. It all culminated during the Rolling Stones' set. What was supposed to be a victory lap for the Stones after a successful U.S. tour became a living nightmare. Following several altercations with the Hell's Angels, concertgoer Meredith Hunter brandished his gun. A Hell's Angel stabbed and killed him. Meredith was just 18 years old. I guess the Stones had no idea this happened until their set was over. I've always felt really weird about the Stones taking the fall for what went down at Altamont when it was Grace and Paul who said, you know, the Hell's Angels, they're we've used them for security before, they're great. And like the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane organized this whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like the Rolling Stones, it wasn't their fault at all. I mean, yeah, you could say they were working with the Hell's Angels before, and that was kind of like the connection that was made. But really, I feel like even just looking at this and how they planned it, it is kind of obvious that something was going to happen. Of course, you wouldn't expect something this horrible to happen, but honestly, the way that you described it, it's not that surprising to me that it didn't go according to plan, because there wasn't really a plan that could have worked in any kind of scenario.
Yes, in a lot of ways, Altamont was, you know, the end of, you know, hippie free love. The Summer of Love kind of pretty clearly ends with that. If you're talking to me, I would say things were going wrong by the 68 DNC, but...
I would love to one day make an episode, but that's not really about a person, but I would love to talk about how the Summer of Love ended, because I think it is so interesting. There were so many things happening at the same time, and it all kind of coincided, even with like the Sharon Tate murders, it all kind of played together, causing for the Summer of Love to end. And I think that's actually quite interesting.
It's like some awful divine drama.
Yeah, it's crazy.
By 1970, Jefferson Airplane were certified icons of the counterculture, and the counterculture was getting more and more radical after all of these events we just described. Despite being one of the biggest bands in America, they still played free concerts. They fought to make their albums less expensive for fans, outraged by the suggested $5.98 price tag for Baxter's. That is understandable, because when I did my calculations to account for inflation, that's like a $56 record or something like that.
I did the same thing. Yeah, it's crazy. And also, I took a look at what other records were at the time, and they were all around the $5 mark, with most of them, from what I could tell, most people online said that they mostly bought them discounted for like $3 to $4. Mm-hmm. So six, that's a lot of money.
Jefferson Airplane aligned themselves with outlaw figures, one of whom Grace would rope into her zaniest scheme yet. This is my second favorite incident in rock and roll history, behind the Hudson's incident.
That's a great one.
I am so glad I get to tell this story to you guys.
Buckle up.
This is the Tea Party incident. Remember that finishing school Grace went to? Another famous alumnus of Finch College is Trisha Nixon, daughter of then U.S. President Richard Nixon. Trisha went down the list of her former classmates and invited 600 of her closest friends to a tea party at the White House. It seems neither Trisha nor anyone at the White House clocked that the Grace Wing on the list was now Grace Slick, singer of Jefferson Airplane. Grace had a plan to slip something even crazier past the Secret Service. 600 micrograms of LSD. She was gonna dump a capsule of the stuff into the president's tea and send him into orbit. On the night of the party, Grace Wing arrived at the White House gates dressed in her Finch girl best. She arrived with her chaperone for the night, Abby Hoffman, dressed in what is said to be a comically bad disguise. See, I know the disguise was literally just taking a shower and shaving his face, but in my mind...
Brushing your hair once.
In my mind, I'm picturing, like, the glasses with the fake nose and the mustache. I don't know why my brain is doing this.
That would be hilarious.
I mean, what he did wasn't much better.
Yeah.
Grace described how she got Abby in on the plot. Quote, "I called him and said, guess where we're going? He's a recurring character in the vinyl Monday verse. We know him as the guy who stormed the Woodstock stage during the Who set calling for John Sinclair's release from prison. Pete Townsend responded by threatening to kill him, then physically throwing him off stage. You don't mess with The Who.
No.
Considering these events and many, many more, including, oh, I don't know, being one of the Chicago Seven, it's safe to say Abby was already on the FBI's radar. As soon as White House security saw his face, the two were turned away. But he did manage to hang a yippie flag on the gates. The best part of this whole thing? Nixon wasn't even at the White House that day. He was off at Camp David.
We said earlier in this episode that Grace's first marriage was dissolved. But the same can't be said for her marriage on paper. Grace and her first husband, Jerry, separated in 1966. However, it wasn't until 1969 that California became the first no-fault divorce state in America.
Okay, so in most basic terms, a no-fault divorce means you don't have to prove one party was the cause of the marriage falling apart in a court of law. In the old days, if one party disputed the other's reasoning for ending the marriage, they'd have to duke it out in court, which is, you know, what Grace and Jerry did for years. As you can imagine, this could get tricky if one person had to prove they were cheated on or abused, even trickier if one partner has total control of finances, as so often happened back then. In best cases, like Grace and Jerry, if they went with no-fault divorce, it simply would have sped up the process and cost less money and legal fees. In worst cases, no-fault divorce can save the lives of victims of domestic violence by getting them out of that situation as soon as possible. Not so fun fact, it took until 2010 for all 50 states to adopt no-fault divorce. Thank you, state of New York, for being the last holdout.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Because they separated before California allowed no-fault divorce, there was a lot more red tape to wade through. Grace's divorce wasn't final for 3 years after her separation from Jerry. In 1969-ish, Grace and Paul linked up. Two bandmates dating, what could possibly go wrong? Paul and Grace were both well-educated free thinkers who fell for each other's creativity and intelligence.
Okay, hear me out. This is one of my biggest hear me outs. I get it, Grace. I've always found Paul kind of cute myself. It might be the glasses. I really think it's my liking for strong personalities. That, and if I take my glasses off, there's a vague resemblance to Ray Manzarek. Anyway, continue.
I never saw that, but when you mentioned that to me, I was kind of like, in my brain, I was like, I guess there is a slight resemblance. They're kind of like the same type of man, I'd say.
It's the long blonde hair and the slightly geeky disposition.
I think so, too. Paul and Grace never got married. The whole relationship setup really reminds me of Stevie Nicks and Lindsay Buckingham. It's kind of the same thing over and over again in these rock and roll relationships. After her years-long divorce, it's safe to assume Grace was thoroughly turned off from the idea of matrimony. Around the White House Tea Party thing, she discovered that she was pregnant. Jefferson Airplane went on a hiatus again so she could go on maternity leave. Spencer Dryden was fired from the band just before this break, while Paul took the opportunity to write and produce his first solo album, Blows Against the Empire, which Grace appears on. On January 25th in 1971, Grace welcomed her only child, a daughter named China Wing. The God a Revolution book makes moves to debunk that China's name was supposed to be God, chalking it up to a joke Grace supposedly made to a nurse. It would be in line with her sense of humor, but it's worth noting that in a 1970s interview with Bang Fong Torres for Rolling Stone, Grace asserted the God name herself, in quotes, "Just God, no last name, no capital G. And he can change his name whenever he feels like it."
Oh, you know, if I have a son, I'm just gonna name him God. No big deal. One thing I learned about Paul from this research is his motto in life, like one of his Paul-isms was, "What are we waiting for?" This, we'll see this with his music, we will see this with the trajectory of the band, and honestly, we'll see it in his relationship with Grace. Like, what are we waiting for? We don't need a piece of paper. Let's just have a family. Let's just start our lives together. They shared this, like, octagon-shaped room at the top of this big black house that was kind of like the Jefferson Airplane commune. They all lived together. Very, you know, very hippie of them to sort of take up residence in this commune.
Yeah. 1971 was a chaotic year for Grace. On top of being a new mother, Jefferson Airplane came out of their hiatus in bad shape. For one, the music industry was changing rapidly. The San Francisco scene evaporated. The Grateful Dead quickly outgrew whatever remained. 60s vanguards Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin passed away. I feel like this was very hard on Grace personally too, as she was good friends with Janis, and both of them were happy to know and have each other in the male-dominated music scene of the late 60s. Mm-hmm. Bands were getting heavier and heavier in the arms race to keep up with another high-flying group, Led Zeppelin. Jefferson Airplane didn't engage. Instead, they got more improvisational, bringing violinist Papa John Creech on board. The thing about Jefferson Airplane is that while most groups have one or two big personalities, they had four. Grace and Paul made music on their own, releasing their Sunfighter album. Baby China appears on the album cover. Meanwhile, Jorma and Jack were all in on Hot Tuna. Both factions of Jefferson Airplane got used to being in charge and had strong opinions about where the band should go. Marty got fed up with the drama and quit the band he founded. Production on what would become Bark was a drag. Everyone was on cocaine. Grace's drinking problem was getting worse. To blow off steam after frustrating record sessions, Jorma and Grace would go drag racing through the streets of San Francisco. On the night of July 13th in 1971, their antics brought them to Doyle Drive, nicknamed Deadly Doyle Drive. It rained earlier that night and the streets were slick with oil. Grace lost control of her Mercedes-Benz, careened off the road, and slammed into an embankment going between 80 and 100 miles per hour. Miraculously, she walked away with a little more than a concussion. Once again, Jefferson Airplane went on hiatus so Grace could recover. In her downtime, she wrote a song about the crash called the Never Argue with a German If You're Tired or European song. This song is written in a fictional language, meaning to sound like German, and I have to give her that. It kind of sounds like German. Put a pin in this story for later.
Bark was released later that year. It was clear the airplane was going down. Jorma and Jack left the band to focus on Hot Tuna full-time. With Grace's issues and a band lineup looking more like a revolving door, it was getting harder and harder to tour. They couldn't get it together to tour in support of Bark. They managed for follow-up album Long John Silver, but that record flopped, not unlike a fish. 1972 was even messier. After a run of shows at the Winterland, the band stopped touring altogether. Side note, I have that live album, 30 Seconds to Winterland. Sounds great. I like the way that lineup of the band sounded.
Oh, to spend a day listening to your record collection.
A day. We'd be here for years.
A year. Yeah.
About a gig in 73, Grace recalls, quote, I'm getting ready to sing. Some guy in the audience shouts, Hey Gracie, take off your chastity belt. I look directly at him and say, Hey, I don't even wear underpants. I pull my skirt up for a beaver shot and the audience explodes with laughter. I can hear the guys in the band behind me muttering, Oh Jesus. She didn't care that she was a mother now. She was still going to be the same old Grace. With Paul and late-stage Airplane member David Freiberg, Grace recorded Baron von Tollbooth and the Chrome Nun. Despite the charming title taken from David Crosby's nicknames for the couple, the album sank like the Titanic. RCA cut off the band's allowances, but the end of Jefferson Airplane wasn't going to slow Grace and Paul down. Both were still hungry as ever to create. So the airplane was refurbished into Jefferson Starship. Side note, Blows Against the Empire was kinda sorta the first Jefferson Starship album. It's got all the same people on that record. After Baron von Tollbooth, but before the first honest-to-goodness Jefferson Starship album, Dragonfly, Grace quietly co-wrote, recorded, and released Manhole. Though it's technically the second Jefferson Starship album, I know this discography gets so weird, Manhole was billed as Grace's first solo effort. It was made in a drug and alcohol-fueled haze. It was supposed to be a film soundtrack, but the film was never made. She wanted some of the lyrics to be in Spanish, so she had the janitor at Wally Hader Studios translate as he emptied the trash. Manhole produced one of the most beautiful deep cuts of Grace's catalog, Jay. It features beautiful guitar and bass playing by Jorma Kaukonen's brother, also named Paul, rhythm guitar by Grace, and her airy, sultry, beautiful vocals. If you think her voice is all belt and no breath, listen to Jay and be proven wrong.
Jefferson Starship was in trouble from day one. They enjoyed massive commercial success after Marty Balin rejoined for the 1975 album Red Octopus. Fun fact, it's the best-selling record by any iteration of the Jefferson lineage of bands. But behind the glitz and glamour of renewed commercial success, Paul and Grace's relationship was in serious trouble. That year, Grace would leave her partner of 5 years for Jefferson Starship's lighting designer, Skip Johnson. On November 29th in 1976, following the release of their album Spitfire, Skip and Grace got married.
Paul moved on after this as well. I don't think he married this woman, but he did have another child. And can I just say, like, leaving your partner and taking up a relationship with a lighting designer... Where have we seen this before? It's Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's the same story. And it's like every now and then this video goes so viral where Stevie Nicks is performing and she's giving like Lindsay the intense side eye. I am so flabbergasted that she's able to do that because I would be so awkward. Like, how does one do that? And Grace, she did the same thing. They went on stage over and over again afterwards.
Honestly, it's the spirit of the 60s. To just sort of have it be water under the bridge. It's like Joni Mitchell breaking up with David Crosby in a song and then dating Graham Nash for 2 years. They were buddies and it just like wild. Wasn't an issue.
I still think the entire construction and like world of 60s relationship within bands is
wild.
It's a philosophy and a psychology of their own. Skip also married Grace's TUI, or talking under the influence, as she called it. She wasn't a fun drunk. She was an angry drunk. It amazes me that she could function well enough to work on another Jefferson Starship album. To Vanity Fair, Grace described what she was like under the influence. In quote, "I turn into a real huge asshole. I'm having a great time being an asshole and everybody else is going, oh Jesus, and the cops are going, take her to jail." In an interview with Louder, she said, in quotes, "If I saw anyone in a uniform, it was over for me. I went to jail a lot for drunk mouth, verbal assault." 1978 was a year of chaos and turmoil as Grace hit rock bottom. She was invited to be a guest judge on The Great Gong Show in January, with hopes that her presence would get more fans in the audience. But people were watching her for all the wrong reasons. She lashed out at the contestants, fought with the other judges, got into it with the audience, and broke several microphones. It ended with her being dragged off stage by security as the audience booed. That same day, she was arrested for driving under the influence. She verbally abused the officers who pulled her over and spent the night in jail.
Fateful summer 1978 tour to promote album Earth almost didn't happen. In her own book, Somebody to Love, she said especially strong words about the whole thing. Quote, "I didn't like pandering to Nazi offspring." On June 17th, she got terribly sick, maybe appendicitis, but probably food poisoning. Her husband, Skip, pushed to cancel the whole thing so she could recover. Paul fought for the tour to go on, saying he wouldn't play without her. He said something to the affect of, "Would the Rolling Stones go on without Mick Jagger?" Because Jefferson Starship's Mick Jagger could not go on, the show was canceled. The night ended with the audience setting fire to the Lorelei Amphitheater and a fist fight backstage between Paul and Skip. Considering this was Grace's ex and Grace's husband, we imagine the bust-up was about a lot more than just the show. You have these kind of two warring factions who kind of have their hearts in it and were really fighting for like what they thought was best for Grace. Then came June 19th.
Yeah.
The thing about Grace is that her alcoholism threw a tank of gasoline on the fire that was her naturally provocative nature. She danced on the line of what was acceptable plenty of times before, flashing and cussing at the audience. All the while, the guys could laugh it off as typical Grace. but when she was drunk, she leapt right over the line. On this night in Hamburg, Grace decided to be a menace. Thankfully, she was talked out of wearing a Nazi uniform on stage. Oh my God, could you imagine how badly that would have gone? But she was so drunk that Marty had to hold her up as they sang. She slurred her way through songs, called the audience Nazis, did the Heil Hitler salute, cussed the audience out, and repeatedly taunted them with, "Who won the war?"
I just have to say, yes, jump in on that this. If you do the Heil Hitler salute in Germany, you will go to jail. Or you will pay a pretty high sum of money. And it is, I don't want to get into politics here, but in Germany, there is this huge issue. Like, generally, still up until this day, there is an issue with, like, right-wing extremists. And that is why the German government is so incredibly strict on all of that. Like, you cannot wear the uniform, you cannot wear the symbols. Even there was a lawsuit because someone wore a Nazi symbol, like a swastika, but it was crossed. But they still, like, had to remove it because it's still the symbol. So I feel like you can think about that what you want. In the end, I think it is good. You need to just, on all ends, make sure that something like what happened in the Second World War is never going to happen again. And while you can say she might have done that and it was all a big joke to her and she didn't meant it from any political stance, I still think it is important to say that it was very right to take her off the stage that night.
This is not an excuse at all, what I'm about to say. This is some important historical context. Grace was born in 1939. So she is a product of the American propaganda machine. She was taught to hate the Germans for World War II from birth. And again, that crops up with her lovely little "I didn't like pandering to Nazi offspring" quote. And this is what happens when you consume the alcohol. And alcohol doesn't make you do things, all right? It just removes the filter. So you do the things you think about doing, but you don't.
Yeah, and it's crazy. And Germany, on the other end, has this whole thing that, like, unless there is a football national championships or something, no one will ever hang out a German flag. It is uncalled for. The whole idea that Americans play allege to the flag in the early mornings or whatever, that is so far off what anyone in Germany would do. And I get it. Like, there's nothing wrong with the Americans doing it. There's nothing wrong with Germany not doing it anymore. It's all a historic context. But I think that the entire show was on thin ice. And what she said, it just comes back to what you were saying. It is okay in some way to think that, and you can have your own thoughts about whatever, that's all up to you, but you just cannot go on stage and say something like that, especially to a generation. Like, that was the 80s. Was it the 80s?
1978.
Yeah, that was so 1978.
This was about 30 something years after the war ended.
And I'm just gonna say, most people attending were probably young. So say they were born in the 50s or so. They didn't have anything to do with what was going down. And I think it is something, even I, growing up in Germany, people always say all Germans are Nazis, and it is something that has upheld itself even now to, like, my generation, who is not in touch with that. And I think as a member of a group, of a country, as a citizen of a country, you have to know the historical context and you have to be aware of all of that. But it's also not okay to go back and tell people what your country did 500 years ago wasn't right.
It's just, I honestly think that the call that Paul made after this was 100% right. This incident was the final straw for Paul, who had previously been Grace's biggest advocate. He went to bat for her place in the band just two nights before. After this, he either fired Grace or asked her to quit. It depends on who you ask. This was absolutely necessary, part because to just get her out of that environment, and partly because she needed help.
Yeah, I think so too. Sometimes you have to hurt people to get them the help that they need.
Whichever it was, whether Grace was fired or quit on her own accord, the Graceless lineup played Nebworth and wrote a song for the infamous Star Wars Christmas special.
Getting fired from Jefferson Starship was a wake-up call for Grace, as it should have been. Gone were the days of the stage antics. They just didn't fly the way they somehow did in the 1960s. The road to sobriety was long and non-linear, but throughout the 80s, she poured her energy into more solo records. She was eventually invited back to Jefferson Starship, which morphed into yet another commercially successful group, Starship after Paul's departure. With their signature song, We Built the City, 46-year-old Grace became the oldest woman to have a number one single in the US. She broke her own record at 47 with Starship Power ballad, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. She held that record until 53-year-old Cher's hit song, Believe, in 1999. About We Built the City, Grace said, in quotes, I felt like a dope singing it, but it went to number one. That's pretty pathetic as regards to people's taste. It seems the public agrees in retrospect. It since appeared on Rolling Stone's and GQ's magazine's Worst Songs of the 80s list. We Built the City chart success was another wake-up call. Grace found she'd lost her passion for music. She was just going through the motions with Starship, a group without any of the original Jefferson Airplane collaborators she loved to work with. In the age of music videos that her daughter China dominated as a MTV VJ, Grace felt like a dinosaur. At age 50, after one last hurrah with Jefferson Airplane, she announced her retirement from music. End quotes. I don't want to see old people doing rap or rock and roll. It makes me cringe. She continually asserted her belief that rock and roll is best left for the youngsters.
After hanging up her microphone and stage duds for good, Grace switched gears to visual art. Quote, the way I paint is similar to rock in that you don't stand around the work and say, gee, what are they talking about? Rock is simple, blunt, colorful. Same with my paintings. You don't stand back and wonder what it is. I don't want to be precious, hang out in Soho, and talk crap about other people's stuff. With her friend Pat Monahan, Grace threw herself into charity work through the Animal Guardians, a nonprofit foundation that funds animal shelters and rescue. In September 1993, Grace lost most of her possessions, including irreplaceable memorabilia from the airplane days, to a brush fire that spread to her home. The fire was reportedly sparked by a negligent county road crew. In 1994, Grace and Skip divorced. The same year, police were called to Grace's home amidst a domestic dispute. She pulled a gun on the officer. Thankfully, it wasn't loaded. After the fire and divorce, Grace moved to Malibu, where she lives and makes art to this day. Grace does still make the occasional appearance. In 1996, two members of the Grateful Dead inducted the classic lineup of Jefferson Airplane to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They were inducted alongside two other female-fronted groups, the Shirelles and Gladys Knight and the Pips. In 2001, she appeared at a benefit for first responders to the 9/11 attacks. Still provocative as ever, she wore a burqa to the event.
Well, I guess in some ways you just stay the person you've always been.
Yeah, I feel like as you get older, it gets harder to hide your true self. Yeah. And if you are a provocateur at your core, you're gonna keep doing that.
Considering their heart-partying ways, it's a miracle so many members of the classic lineup of Jefferson Airplane are still with us today. Jorma Kaukonen is 83 now. He published his autobiography a few years ago. Jack Cassidy turned 80 this past April and kept Hot Tuna going with Jorma for a long time. Founding member of the Airplane and Grace's ex, Paul Kentner, formed multiple Jefferson Starship reunion lineups, playing with them on and off stage from 1984 until his death in January of 2016. He passed on the same day as Signe Anderson. China, a pretty cool lady in her own right, remains active in upholding her father's legacy. Marty passed in 2018. Him and Grace never fully reconciled. Grace Slick is 84 years old as of this episode's release and has no plans to ever come out of retirement. Her favorite subject to paint? White rabbits, of course.
If anybody has a spare $10,000 lying around and would like to give me a birthday gift, since this episode will be going up on my birthday, there you go. There's your answer.
Yeah, everybody, go to Abby's Instagram and wish her a happy birthday. It's going to be her birthday the day that this episode comes out. Yeah, it's called for.
I mean, honestly, the best way to celebrate is just by listening to this episode, which you've done if you've made it this far. Congratulations. Yeah. And by just, like, playing the loudest record you have and probably pissing off your neighbors. That's a great way to celebrate me. If you ask
me... A very Abby way.
Yes! If you ask me, Grace doesn't get enough credit for her influence on pop culture and the development of psych rock compared to her male peers. Aside from a couple tunes here and there, I'm not a huge fan of her music post-Airplane. There are several incidents we've detailed here today that I strongly disagree with. But for who she was and what she represented in The Summer of Love, what she still means to music now, refusing to dilute herself for anyone, and simply for being quotable as hell, she'll always be an icon to me.
She truly is.
And that was episode 2 of our podcast. Woo! That was the Grace Slick episode. Thank you for tuning in to our second ever episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life and career of the one and only Grace Slick.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you hear, you should subscribe to this podcast. There should be a button around here somewhere, and review us on your chosen streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us and helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
We would also like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro tune. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.